This is Molly Smith, host of From the Median. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Laura Hollis, Associate Professor at University of Notre Dame and contributor to Town Hall Online. Her topic is, Christian conservatives must reclaim the high ground through defending our God-given principles.
Thank you, Star. Okay, two things I have to do. First, I have to pull the microphone down so you can hear me and also so you can see me. And then I also have to take my glasses off because I'm in total denial about needing bifocals, and either I can see you or I can see what I wrote. And it's probably more important that I see what I wrote. At least initially, I'll put the glasses back on when it's time for questions. It's a real pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to meet Star Parker. When I was told that she was going to be introducing me, I said, really, really? I've been reading her stuff for years, so I'm so excited. Thank you for that introduction, and thanks to Molly Smith and to Cleveland Right to Life for inviting me here and for having the opportunity to speak to you all today. I've looked at the names of the many accomplished individuals who are speaking this weekend, and it's really a privilege to be in that group. I want to start with a true story. This is how you know I'm not running for office, because I'm starting with a true story. A little over 30 years ago, I was sitting in a lecture hall at Notre Dame, where I went to college. I was a sophomore in college there, and taking a child development psychology class, the professor's name was Jeannie Day, and that day she was lecturing about the emotional development of children and the impact of abuse. Professor Day said something that I had never, at least until then, heard before. She quoted a statistic, I don't remember the precise number, in which demonstrated that children who were abused were exponentially more likely to become abusers themselves. At that moment, I had an epiphany. I remember it like it was yesterday. I felt like someone had smacked me upside the head with a 2x4, and the words that popped into my head were these: sins of the fathers will be visited unto the sons until the fourth generation. I sat bolt upright in my lecture seat. Probably didn't happen very often. This was a biblical passage that had troubled me as a young person for a long time. I couldn't figure out why God would punish children for something that their parents did. At that moment, it occurred to me that perhaps it had been interpreted incorrectly. That, in fact, children suffer the effects of their parents' sins, and those effects can, in fact, last for multiple generations. Those of us that have experience with substance abuse, for example, know just how true that is. From that moment on, I became fascinated, and I might even say obsessed, with finding the relationship between the tenets of Judeo-Christian principles and science. And that leads me to the main theme in my remarks here today. If you've been paying attention over the past few years, you've probably noticed that the level of hostility has really ramped up among those who seek to create the impression that there's some insurmountable divide between science and religious faith. It has become fashionable among certain elites to sneer at people of faith, atheists like Richard Dawkins, the late Christopher Hitchens, and even Stephen Hawking have written bestsellers in which belief in God is derided as being anti-scientific. This is a ruse, but I submit it's one that we've fallen for. The easiest way to marginalize a Christian today is to turn the social issues into a debate about morality. Then we let ourselves get painted into a corner. Oh, that's just a Catholic viewpoint, or you're only saying that because you're a Christian. We're a diverse society. You can't legislate morality. That's just a matter of religious belief. Not everyone thinks like you. And, of course, the insult, all you folks who believe in sky pixies are just anti-science. Nowhere are the left's fallacies more apparent than in the realm of science. I think Christians tend to be timid, perhaps because we feel we cannot prove the existence of God or of the soul or of the afterlife. And sometimes, if we're honest, it's because we're too busy fighting amongst ourselves over dogmatic minutiae. We tend to stay out of the debates in which science plays a role and behave as if morality is somehow in a different sphere, just a matter of faith. In fact, in some circles, Christians themselves treat science as if it is a threat to our faith. I have never understood either the hostility or the willingness to roll over. Believers have nothing to fear from science. Science is one of our greatest weapons in the war on lies, because science, at its core, is the pursuit of truth. Allowing ourselves to be ostracized from any discussion involving science eliminates the possibility that we can use science to advance the truths of our faith system. Nor is there any conflict between science and faith in God. The God who created the magnificent reality that we discover when we study astrophysics and quantum mechanics and microbiology is the God of science. If science is the pursuit of truth, then a scientific truth is a glimpse, however minuscule, of the power of God. There are many who would find this unremarkable, perhaps even obvious. But we need to take it a step further. If all of that is true, and I believe it is, then there should also be a connection between morality, which is legitimately grounded in God's word, and science. There is, and the proof is everywhere. In fact, what's really astonishing is how completely unscientific so many aspects of the contemporary progressive worldview are, and how utterly unwilling others are to point this out. Abortion is by no means the only example, but it is perhaps the most egregious one. When it comes to abortion, as we all know, the most basic sciences, biology, genetics, are not only ignored, they're mischaracterized in the most deceptive ways. For the past 40 years, what have the pro-choice talking points been? One, that it is the woman's body. Well, while there is a woman involved in this, of course, this is biologically, scientifically incomplete. The child in the womb has his own body, her own body. He or she has a sex, distinct and separate DNA, genetic material, blood type. Second, it's just a clump of cells. Well, that's also false, unless, of course, you're willing to admit that every creature on earth is basically a clump of cells. That the child in the womb cannot feel pain. Not true. And apparently not even relevant, since legislative efforts to restrict abortions after the point where the child in utero can feel pain meet the same resistance from abortion defenders as restrictions earlier in the gestation period. My personal favorite, it's just a fetus. Etymology helps here. The word fetus derives from the Latin word for offspring and describes a developmental phase of the human child in utero. Nothing about the word fetus denotes anything other than a human baby, no matter how much the pro-choice crowd protests. The pro-life movement was defending the rights of the unborn child years ago, before we had the technological capabilities that we do now, when all we had, and I'm using the word all advisedly here, was a moral argument. But what has advanced our views of and our understanding of the developing human child in utero? What has changed the minds of some of the most formerly strident pro-abortion advocates like Dr. Bernard Nathanson, Abby Johnson, ultrasound, science, and technology? What has pushed back the age of viability? Science and technology. What has enabled us to treat neonates and even do surgery on children still gestating? Scientific study and advances in medical technology. It is no coincidence that the murder trial of Kermit Gosnell last year was ignored by the media. The last thing they want is for Americans to see the truth, which is that someone who can tell themselves that a child in the womb is not a human being can tell themselves that a child outside the womb is not a human being. There is not one shred of scientific truth that makes what Kermit Gosnell did any different from what is done in abortion facilities across this country on any given day. In fact, the pro-choice movement knows that they cannot prevail in any scientific argument. Just last week, Cecile Richards, the president of Planned Parenthood, said in response to a question about when life begins that it, quote, wasn't really relevant to the conversation. And then she went on to say that in her view, life began for her three children when she delivered them. There isn't a biologist on the planet who would stand by that statement. But it isn't just abortion where the progressive worldview pays little heed to science. Consider the attitudes we now endure towards sexuality generally. We're told that teaching our young people to exercise self-restraint with their sexuality until they're married is unrealistic, that we need to encourage them to have safe sex, that this is a healthier attitude about sexuality than was the case in my parents' or grandparents' day. What is their definition of healthier? Look it up. How many people had sexually transmitted diseases in the 1950s? The percentage was much, much smaller than it is now, and it was largely confined to distinct segments of the population. Among young people aged 15 to 24, the numbers were so small they were barely kept. Now the number of young people with an STD is 1 in 4. In some areas, it's 1 in 3. That's the level of sexually transmitted diseases that's typically seen among sex workers in third world countries. But somehow the most advanced country on earth cannot bring itself to admit that indiscriminate sex that spreads disease is primitive, not civilized behavior. This is basic anthropology and epidemiology. And this is without even mentioning the psychological disorders associated with early sexual activity in young people, depression, anxiety, low self-esteem, self-mutilation, anorexia, bulimia, bullying, suicide attempts. The statistics rack up, and we ignore them. And it isn't just the hard sciences that bear us out. The proof is throughout the social sciences as well. 40 years ago, we were told that no-fault divorce would be better for women and children, that removing the social stigma from unwed motherhood would be liberating. No one wants to return to a time when women were trapped in abusive relationships or to punish innocent children for their birth circumstances. But we must also acknowledge that the social costs of easy divorce, broken homes, and single parenthood have been devastating. Ironically, it's women and children who've suffered disproportionately, thrust into poverty. Entire swaths of the American population, particularly in our inner cities, although not exclusively, have been decimated by crime, drug addiction, and gang activity that have filled the vacuum created by the absence of fathers and the dissolution of families. Even in upper-income segments of society, children from broken homes, raised by single parents, or otherwise deprived of relationships with their father or other parent, often have deep emotional and psychological scars that are manifesting themselves in many destructive behaviors. The numbers of people displaying these behaviors have exploded, and yet we ignore the scientific evidence because it's inconvenient. Taking our culture in a better direction starts with the courage to speak up and to tell the truth. We need to be looking for all of the places where science supports us, supports the Judeo-Christian perspective on individual behavior, including sexuality, marriage, strong families, healthy children, healthy choices. In fact, Jesus Christ's words were filled with scientific truths, truths that in many respects we've only begun to understand. Take, for example, his teaching that we should forgive our brother 70 times, seven times. Why did he say that? Was that just a moral admonition? Your brother doesn't deserve it, but God demands it, so you have to do it. I don't think so. Psychology and sociology have demonstrated that not only does forgiveness resolve interpersonal conflict, but that there is a direct and observable physiological response to forgiveness. It is actually healthier for the forgiver to forgive. We should not be surprised by any of this. God advises the things that he does because he knows us. He knows us as a father knows his children. He knows us as the creator knows the created. What God advises us to do and to avoid, those things which we have tended to call morality, he has done because he loves us and because he knows what will bring creativity, happiness, and human flourishing, and that which will produce misery and suffering, illness and death, personal devastation, and even societal collapse. These truths are profound. They are universal. They are scientifically demonstrable. And so we are missing the opportunity to convey them to our brothers and sisters when we confine morality to the realm of denominational dogma. Science and morality is literally, I believe, a marriage made in heaven. When one looks at history, there are basically two methods that humans use to get what they want. In oppressive society, raw power. But in free societies, we depend upon persuasion. I frankly think that persuasive argument is one of the attributes of humanity that demonstrates our creation in the image and likeness of God. God himself has given us free will and respects our use of it. We can do no less with our fellow man. We acknowledge the dignity of every human being when we appeal to their reason and attempt to persuade them. But we cannot persuade anyone if we remain silent, whether out of a misguided sense of courtesy or because we feel ignorant or intimidated or afraid. And we certainly cannot if we tacitly accede to the position that science is only for the faithless. We have to speak out at every opportunity. We have to be part of every conversation. We have to reach out. We have to evangelize. Science can be a marvelous tool in that evangelization. Christ said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." We owe it to ourselves, to our neighbors, to our country, and to the rest of the world to be a vehicle and a voice for that freedom. Thank you.
Oh, you're there.
Got it right. Well, another wonderful presentation. Am I going to get that extra microphone again? That would be kind of cool because we have Q&A opportunities, but I don't know if our youth got a chance to get the cards out to you. Okay. All right. Well, I know I have a question for you I'd like to engage because you're working with the mainstream media when you think about a town hall and other avenues that you have opportunity, as well as a professor. How do you converge these two and be able to maintain your faith and keep your job?
Well, I haven't always kept my job, but I'm still working. I think the bottom line is to assume that most people are rational, self-interested, but also interested in the betterment of society, the betterment of humanity. I think one of the things that's become unfortunate is that our political discourse and other discourse has become so bifurcated. You know, we don't even attempt to reach out to people that we perceive disagree with us. And maybe, I guess, I have the good fortune of having been both in the entertainment business and in academia. I have always been sort of more to the right of most of the people that I've worked with, and I'm still here to talk about it. In fact, I often say that, you know, people like me, and then they find out that I'm conservative, and it's, at that point, it's too late. So I think really getting down to what matters to people, understanding where they're coming from, being able to reach out and say, you know, the term that I use is better choices. I mean, I gave an interview to the Irish Rover, which is one of the student papers at the University of Notre Dame, and I said, I'm pro-choice. I'm just pro-better choice. I mean, so... And one of the things that I observed, you know, now that I have the opportunity to advise young people, college students, and I can look back and see what an idiot I was and say, okay, can I just keep you from doing all the stupid things that I did, you know, to admit my failings and instead of, you know, touting them or proclaiming them, saying, no, you know, I really don't want you to do the things that I did. So my take with a lot of the students is, look, when you make a better choice, you put yourself on a better path. Each time you make a less good choice, shall we say, it gets harder to turn it around. Okay, so if you don't put yourself in a situation where you could have, you know, a sexual relationship that could produce something, then you don't end up in that situation. Right? If you don't put yourself in a sexual situation, you don't have to worry about contraception or ingesting artificial hormones and things like that. Notice how much more difficult they get as you go along. Oops, your contraceptive method has failed. Now you're pregnant and you're 20. And now what are your choices? Well, they're more difficult all along. So why don't we just, you know, kind of take a look at the trajectory that some of these choices produce and say, wouldn't you rather make the better choice when it's easier? Because it really does get harder as you go along. And I think if you're rational and you explain it to people, it's astonishing how often that you can actually reach them.
Okay. One of the questions, I knew this question was coming. Catholic universities are increasingly removing themselves from Catholic teaching. What do you see as the solution to this?
Jesus Christ was in the minority. I don't think we should be uncomfortable with that. I mean, I think that's just a fact of life, that those of us that are saying there's a better way to do things, may not seem easier, but it's better in the long term, are always going to be fighting against the tide. Sometimes we're fighting against the tide in our own hometowns or in our universities. Other times it may feel like it's just part of the greater culture, but you know, we have to believe that we're doing the right thing. And again, this is, I think, where being able to point to scientific truth, say, okay, look, I'm not standing out here on a street corner, you know, bellowing things that aren't demonstrably true. There's all kinds of history that we can look at, science that we can point to. I mean, I think what you do is we put the shoe on the other foot and, you know, tell them, okay, you've had your 40, 50 years. How's that working out for you? I mean, seriously. Now, another thing that we get a lot, too, is you just want to take us back to the 1950s. Well, that depends on what you're talking about. Okay, gas prices.
Yeah.
Love it, right? I mean, the way kids behaved in school, public schools in the 1950s, sure, all kinds of things. Was everything great in the 1950s? No. I mean, okay, I have one word for you, Shakespeare. I don't want to live in the 17th century either, but we still read him. We listen to Bach. We listen to Mozart. We read Plato and Aristotle, and I don't think anybody wants to go back and live in the world 2,000 years ago either. The point is that we should be able to look back and say, what did we do right? Okay. Maybe we should be able to go back and say, some of those things were better. Not everything. Right. But what we know, we've experimented with, and this didn't work, you know, why do we have to say, well, we've done it that way, so we're going to keep doing it that way? Dinesh D'Souza was giving a speech this week at CPAC in which he said, Progressives love to tell you that change equals progress, but not all change is progress. I think we have to admit that.
We're getting to where we can admit it, as you were saying, with science. And this question is, how does science speak to the moral truth of the common good?
Okay, I'm a lawyer, not a philosopher. Yeah. How does science speak to the moral truth of the common good? Right, I'm thinking on the top of my head. You guys are as bad as my students.
I told you this was an
intelligent crowd. They're good.
And they're intelligent
and they're
early in the morning.
Too, and I'm not grading you, which means, you know, there's none of that.
I'm teaching moral theology, and that's what I'm trying to get along to the kids.
Okay, is this your question? Okay, all right, I'll see what I can do. Human flourishing, in a nutshell. You know, when I think about it, and I speak a lot to business groups, and I am an inveterate apologist for American business, or as I sometimes joke, I'm an unapologetic corporate tool. But one of the things that I ask my students to look at is the lifting of human condition that has happened as a result of commerce. And so I think, related to your question, how does science point to, you know, the moral truths of the common good? I think there are all kinds of advances in science that we can point to. Say, look at how much better things are, right? Science is a tool. Technology, I guess I should say, is a tool. You know, so you can use it for good or you can use it for ill. I mean, nuclear technology can be used for bombs, and we don't want to do that. So to suggest that, you know, science is in and of itself moral, I would never go that far. And I'm not suggesting that. But I think what you can look at is the extent to which scientific advances have improved the human condition and ask ourselves, does not that not appear to be a moral good, at least, and to draw in the philosophers who've discussed that?
The science certainly does make our life easier, and so I appreciate your answer on that. And I think I mentioned to write your questions in English so that I will be able to not just see them but read them. But I'm trying. Okay, but this one is written pretty accurately in English, but I can't read a couple of words. But it seems like what they want is knowing that the evidence is clear on the statistics. They put STDs, divorce. Why don't the candidates speak of the? If you have the evidence, then what is their trouble to speak out?
They're afraid of the media. They don't have the courage of their convictions, and they're afraid of the media. They're going to get spun. Okay, well, here's the deal. Spin or be spun. You either control your message or your message is controlled by somebody else. I mean, I think that's frankly a lot of it. You're just going to say, okay, look, you know, you may want to do this, but it's not good for you. Why is it that on one side we have people telling us, oh, you have to eat this and drink this and do that, and they're unapologetic about it, right? As I put in an article that I wrote for the Christian Post back in September, we don't have any difficulty looking at the collective impact, you know, on the environment of our carbon footprint, but we're forbidden from discussing the collective impact of the more intimate decisions that we make, shall we say. They're just as important, right? So I think, again, if you can point to statistics, if you can point to science, right, and if you can avoid sounding like someone out of the 1600s, you know, again, this is why I think, you know, we live in an advanced society. We're never going to persuade everybody. We're not going to throw people back in the stocks because they're having an affair, okay? Let's just accept that. But in an era where so many people are educated, why can we not say, let's persuade you to make a better choice. And here's why. I think most people would find that compelling. Not everybody. It'll never be everybody. If it was possible to perfect society, I venture to say, Christ probably would have done it. If he didn't, I don't think we should expect to. But we can make it better.
Very nice. Someone wants to know if you watched the Ken Ham versus Bill Nye debate, and if you did, what do you think?
I didn't watch it, but I give Bill Nye, the science guy, credit for doing it. Right, for just saying, okay, I think we should talk to each other. Nowhere is there probably more of this kind of friction than around the topic of evolution, and I'm not an evolutionary scientist, so if I start speaking, I'll betray my ignorance here quickly. I will just say this. You know, well, I'll tell you another story, and this will pretty much give you my take on it. When I was in law school, one of my faculty was a wonderful man, devout man, and we were in a jurisprudence class, and he said, I think the earth is only 40,000 years old. And I adored him, and I was very curious about this, and I said, Professor, what do you make of carbon dating? And he said, well, you know, God is all powerful. He can make things look old, even if they're not. And I thought about that for a second, and I said, yeah, but why would he? It's not like he's going anywhere. And, well, this is what happened. You know, my classmates are sort of tittering about it, and they thought I was being flip. But truthfully, I just looked and I said, but in what other context do we see things that aren't really what they are? I mean, I suppose he's all powerful. He can just sort of zap people down onto the planet fully grown, but he doesn't. I mean, there's a gestation period and a development period, and it takes 9 months or 40 weeks, and then we're born, and then we continue to develop, and some of us live to be 100, and some of us don't. So, you know, again, I think there we look as if science is antithetical to our faith. And I look at the past, and I say, okay, there was a time when, you know, people said you have to believe that the sun revolves around the earth. Well, that wasn't true, and Christianity survived it. And I imagine that we'll survive the other scientific revelations, too, as long as we see that they really are informing us more about the person that created all of it.
Yeah, yeah. Perhaps more should go into the sciences. Catholics are strong pro-life, but how can we take this pro-life message to be embraced by the non-Catholic or Christian?
I think the first thing we can say is this isn't about Catholicism. This is about science. Right. We're not talking about wearing a particular article of clothing or what day you go to church or that kind of thing. We're talking about basic biology, number one. Okay. And number two, we're also talking about constitutional rights. Okay. So for a long time, you know, the pro-choice movement was able to say, well, it's not really a human being. But if you go back and read Roe v. Wade, it doesn't say that. It says that they're not a person within the meaning of the 14th Amendment. That's pretty specific, okay? It also has a really lousy track record, right? Anytime a government declares an entire class of people to be non-persons within the meaning of the law, bad stuff happens after that. How do you have to be Catholic to understand that? That's just precedent.
Oh, good answer. Okay, how do you respond to atheists when they say, if there's a God, why would he allow pain, suffering, death to innocents, Sandy Hook, Haiti, hurricanes, etc.?
Number one, the answer to that is, I don't know. I don't know, right? If I were a scientist and investigating something that I didn't know, I wouldn't be ashamed to say, I don't know that. That's why I'm looking. That's why I'm trying to find out, right? Sometimes what looks like suffering turns out to be something quite different. I have a good friend I'm thinking of that has a child with fairly serious disabilities. And that child has not only changed her life, it's changed the life of her family. It's changed the lives of everyone in our community. She's arranged to have an enormous facility built, an equal access recreational facility, equal access meaning all kinds of people with various disabilities. I mean, so you look and think, I don't know. I mean, does God use us to bring great things out of suffering? Possibly. Sometimes a struggle creates achievement that we never saw. Now, that doesn't explain things like Sandy Hook. I wouldn't even purport to justify something like Sandy Hook. On the other hand, I have said this. If I come up and smack the you-know-what out of you, that's my problem. God didn't make me do that, and it wouldn't be fair to blame him for it. So I think when you look at natural disasters, we have to sort of throw up our hands and say, I have no answer for that, right? When we look at the things that human beings do to each other, I have a hard time blaming God for that one.
Oh, good answer. My, such insight and wisdom at Notre Dame. Who knew? Oh, I forgot you said because we're live streaming, we weren't going to cut in those jokes. Okay. How do you address the idea that the pro-life movement suffers a lack of progress because our use of science demonstrates a lack of faith in God? This is popular among now young evangelicals.
I don't think we've suffered a lack of progress at all. First of all, how long did slavery exist as a human institution before it was abolished? And in some places, we're still struggling to abolish it. Okay, I mean, Thomas Sowell, I think, has some of the great quotes about this. He says, it's not why does slavery exist or why does cruelty exist, but he said, how have we done such a good job here of eliminating some of the ills that other civilizations have suffered from? I don't think we're losing the battle, the pro-life battle. I mean, if you look at statistically the numbers of Americans who think that abortion should be legal in very narrow circumstances, is really high, at record highs, all right? And so I think if you measure things by the polls, and I don't, but if you do, then there's enormous success there. There's also great scientific evidence that demonstrates the truth of it. I would never take a gift from God and say, sorry, I don't want that. I believe in the old Arab adage, believe in God, but tie your camel tight, right? I mean, if we've got it on our side, let's use it.
As soon as I take the glasses off.
See,
we're opposite.
I can't
sisters.
Read it.
Okay, you take yours off to see your notes. I have to put mine on. Are there resources that we can go to make the scientific help, to get the scientific help that we might need for the right to life cause?
Probably, although I don't write, off the top of my head think of any. I think I'm always just reading, mm-hmm. reading. And so if you think about it, anything that you're reading about scientific advances in ultrasound. I noticed, you've got the 4D ultrasound out there. Mm-hmm. Surgical advances in gestating children, the surgeries that can be done in utero and spina bifida and things like that. I mean, one of the things that doesn't get discussed very much, and I find this interesting too, but you kind of have to pull it together from various sources. You know, they'll talk about, pro-choice people will talk about the diminishing access to abortion, diminishing access to clinics. But what they don't like to tell you is one of the reasons that there's diminishing access is because doctors don't like to do it.
Yeah.
You don't like to be in one surgical theater doing everything you can to save one baby at 26 weeks or 28 weeks and then going across the hall and saying, well, this one doesn't count. Doctors don't like to do them. And, there's a reason for that, because they see it every day. They see the advances in technology and what it enables them to do. And, doctors, most of them, devote their lives to saving lives.
One thing I might want to point out for this questioner is, again, the tapes that are available. In case you weren't here last year, we had many presenters who addressed this very question. So if you're looking for deeper insight and information in terms of literature to read, last year there are quite a few, I think even maybe three that I can think of off the top of my head that addressed specifically that question.
Good.
So thank you. Even though that meant they were really trying to get you to write a book on it. Okay, so we're going to give you one more assignment. In addition to all that you're already doing. All right, the final question is, any guidelines for breaking through the polarization in our relationships and politics that will allow authentic reason and persuasion to break through?
Well, here I think is where social media has taught us so much. Mm. The power of reaching out and talking to the person who's right next to you. After the postmortem column went viral, following the 2012 election, I had so many people emailing me saying, what do we do? I don't know. If I knew that, I guess I would do it. But one of the things that I would tell them is talk to everybody you know, right? I mean, reach out and talk to people. Reach out particularly to people you don't think necessarily are receptive, right? So I think we have a natural tendency to sort of congregate among like-minded, and there's good reason for that, because we sort of have to retreat from the world from time to time and lick our wounds, and especially those of us that are putting ourselves out there as writers. But look in your own community and say, who could we talk to? Can we talk to young people? Can we, maybe reach out to libertarians? There's a strong pro-life libertarian movement in the United States. Who can you get involved in that? Look for the evidence, right? Again, I think what we should be doing is look for the evidence, look for the data, look for the statistics, and then talk to anybody that will listen, and even some who won't. And don't shut up. Don't stop. I mean, Winston Churchill's famous quote, never give up. Never, ever, 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 ever give up. I'm misquoting him because I don't have it in front of me.
I think that was in the Untouchables, too.
Right. Yeah. It's good. Clarence Darrow. And Al Capone, all of it. I mean, we have truth on our side. We have science on our side. Mm-hmm. We have life on our side.
Right.
Why would we shut up?
That's right.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Laura Hollis, Associate Professor at University of Notre Dame and contributor to Town Hall Online and 2014 Bringing America Back to Life Symposium speaker. This presentation was brought to you by Cleveland Right to Life, where through prayer, action, voting, and education, we are bringing America back to life.